Welcome to Disinformation Wars, a project of the American Foreign Policy Council. I'm AFPC Senior Vice President Ilan Berman. Disinformation Wars is a series of conversations with officials, experts, and practitioners designed to take you behind the scenes of the struggle for hearts and minds of global publics that's now taking place around the world. It's a contest being waged by Russia, China, Iran, and other actors, and the stakes could not be any higher. Russia's war in Ukraine has hit the Kremlin's once formidable propaganda machine hard. Practically overnight, Moscow's long-running influence campaign in the West has appeared to founder in the face of less accommodating policy. European governments have tightened restrictions on Russian disinformation, banning state outlets like RT and Sputnik from broadcasting, and they have eyed a raft of new restrictions that are designed to limit Moscow's malign influence. To be sure, some of these setbacks have been the products of self-inflicted messaging wounds. For instance, Russian officials probably could have reasonably expected that their arguments about the need to denazify a country with a Jewish president would be met with widespread ridicule. Russian tropes about satanic practices in Ukraine, as well as U.S.-sponsored biolabs there, have also turned out to be less than convincing. Even so, the current triumphalism that's being felt by many in the West about the fact that Russia is on the back foot in informational terms is probably quite premature. That's because, although Russian propaganda outlets may now find it more difficult to message to European nations, they're still making major gains in advancing the Kremlin's position and eroding the position of the West throughout the developing world. And Latin America is a case in point. There, Russian propaganda actors have tapped into local grievances to advance narratives that are deeply anti-Western and pro-Russian. This messaging, in turn, is helping to push a changing region further and further away from the United States and its partners, and closer to players like Russia and China. Moreover, because most Americans don't pay much attention to Latin America, most of this is happening under the radar, without a real response, or even recognition from Washington. Just how extensive and successful this campaign has been is what I wanted to discuss with my next guest, Joseph Humar. Joseph is the executive director of the Center for Secure Free Society and an expert on Latin American politics. A former Marine, Joseph regularly briefs the U.S. military and foreign governments on security threats and political trends in the Americas, and serves as a national security commentator for a variety of English and Spanish language media. He's also the co-editor, with me, of an extensive study on Iranian activity in the Western Hemisphere, entitled Iran's Strategic Penetration of Latin America. Joseph, it's terrific to have you on.
Great. Thank you, Alon. It's a pleasure to be on.
All right. I'd love if we could start with a bit of an overview on Latin America, because, you know, I'm painfully aware that most people don't follow the region closely. You do, though. So it'd be great if you could give us at least a short summary of what we've witnessed in the region in recent years. How are the Americas in play, so to speak, in political terms? What's changed there? And what really hasn't?
You're right, Ilan, that the region has a bit of a political pendulum, as most regions do, that shift over periods of time. And I know if you go to Latin American historians, they'll give you the 500-year history. I won't do that for the sake of the audience. But what we'll do is we'll talk about the 21st century, the last 22 years. And there have been interesting developments in Latin America. I'd say the first big development was what they called the pink tide, a shift towards the left. The political pendulum swung to the left in the first decade of the 21st century, from ostensibly 2000 to 2010. Really, it was exemplified by Hugo Chavez, the election of Hugo Chavez, which happened the year prior in 99. But then after he consolidated power within Venezuela, he immediately focused on his near abroad. And so we had the resurgence of Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua. We had the election of Evo Morales in Bolivia. Even before that, you had the election of Lula da Silva in Brazil. And then Nestor Kirchner, who was the husband and now late husband to the later president, Cristina Kirchner. And so essentially, you had this wave of socialist populist leaders emerging to power in Latin America, why they called it the pink tide. But then as we hit 2010, around that give or take a year or two, the political pendulum began to swing to the right. It was a reaction to a lot of the failed policies of the pink tide governments. And, you know, some Latin American commentators have called this the conservative wave. You can argue whether these presidents were conservative or not in their philosophy, but what they were is they were certainly much more market friendly, business oriented. And also they were very U.S. friendly, much more centric to be able to align their foreign policies with the United States. And I'll rattle off a few names. Sebastian Piñera was one of the first from Chile, President Iván Duque from Colombia, President Mauricio Macri from Argentina, even President Pablo Kuczynski from Peru. But the one that really grabbed people's attention was in late 2018 when President Jair Bolsonaro won in Brazil, because it was a surprise to a lot of people. And that was really, I think, the high watermark for this conservative wave. And so the big difference, Ilana, I think for your audience to understand, the big difference between these two political pendulum shifts from the left to the right was, one, their approach towards democratic institutions, two, their geopolitical alignments, and three, their understanding of foreign policy. And I'll kind of really quickly just unwrap that. On the first one, the pink tide had a tendency or a trend towards authoritarianism. In the beginning years of those governments, it was hard to tell, and many people were kind of a wishful hopefulness that they wouldn't go that direction. But now we know, like in the case of Nicaragua, that that's no longer a democracy, that's an autocracy. Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, very much in that same direction. And had it not been that Cristina Kirchner was defeated eventually in her re-election bids, Argentina might have been an autocracy at this point. So that's one of the things. The second thing, I think, Ilan, for the audience to really understand, is the geopolitical alignment, because the conservative wave governments, or the right of center governments that came into power in the second decade, didn't really have a geopolitical vision. They thought that they could trade with the United States and China, and that it would all just be beneficial, or that they could buy weapons from the United States and Russia, and it wouldn't go into any type of clash. Or Iran, many of them just didn't factor in at all and discounted. And my point is to say that they tried to get along with everyone, and in sense didn't clearly define their friends, their allies, and their adversaries. As opposed to the initial pink tide governments, the more socialist populist governments, they clearly, through policy and through rhetoric, preferred China, Russia, and Iran over the United States, and actually aligned their country's foreign policy in that direction, even in the beginning when they had historic defined institutional relations with the United States. Venezuela, for instance, was once one of the top military partners of the United States in the 1990s. Today, the U.S. does not even have an ambassador inside Caracas. So that's essentially how the region has transformed over the last 20 so years.
What you're describing, and you mentioned Russia, China, and Iran, and I want to drill down on that, because your narrative highlights something very important. You're talking about a region that's deeply influenced by external actors. You and I have cooperatively spent a lot of time and done a lot of work on the activities of one of those actors, on the activities of Iran. And I want to circle back to that later in our chat. But for the moment, give us an overview of which foreign countries are working actively in Latin America and what they're doing to advance their interests there and why.
We can look at each one of these external actors, I think, in a different lens to some level, because there's different characteristics. There's different, in many ways, I wouldn't say a different approach, but maybe like a different method in which they engage different countries in the region. But you can also look at a lot of similarities. I'll begin with that, and then I'll try to make some of the distinctions. The similarities is in the fact that all these external actors, and namely I'm focusing on Russia, China, and Iran, have all looked at Latin America as a fertile territory, because it's a region that's very new to democracy, right? It's a region that only gained its independence 200 years ago. And many of the countries that gained their independence were into dictatorships all the way up until the mid to late 20th century. So many of these countries didn't actually have a democratic experiment until the late 20th century. And so for that, I think these countries understood that history and looked at it as vulnerable for different types of attacks. When I say attacks, I mean asymmetric attacks, disinformation, changing the narrative, and things like that. Now, another area I think that really centers on how these external actors have aligned themselves in Latin America is something I call the three-quarter standard. What I mean by that is, today in Washington, you have a lot of conversation about strategic competition or strategic cooperation among these actors. Like Russia and China are historical adversaries during the Cold War. Iran's a theocratic state, no friend of communism. And so you have all these 20th century differences that history has taught us about these big, what once were big empires. But what we've seen in the 21st century, and at least in the case of Latin America, is a strategic alignment among these three, because they found a working group inside Latin America that would advance their authoritarian interests. This is called the ALBA, the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas. They were at the heart of that pink tide that I was talking about at the beginning of the 21st century. So if you look at, for instance, Russian foreign military sales, something that Russia does all over the world, is one of their major sources of economic revenue. In Latin America, 75% or three quarters of its foreign military sales went to four countries: Bolivia, Nicaragua, Venezuela, and Cuba. If you extend that over to China, now China's everywhere. China's one of the top trade partners of half of Latin America. But if you look at just credits, not the investments, not the trade, not the big numbers that they do throughout Latin America, but specifically credits that allow them to provide soft loans that aren't going to be paid back. They're basically credits they give to a country to be able to insert influence inside that country. 75% or three quarters of the credits that China has given to Latin America are to the same four countries that Russia has given foreign military sales: Venezuela, Nicaragua, Bolivia, and Cuba. And if you extend that to Iran, those are the same four countries that Iran has done three quarters of its bilateral agreements. So what that does is it allows them to have a platform through this Bolivarian Alliance network to be able to increase their presence and influence and shift the region away from democracy and more towards a more authoritarian style of government.
So let's talk about Russia specifically. Since the start of the current war in Ukraine, the reception for Russian propaganda, at least in Europe and the United States, has become decidedly chilly. And I wonder, is that also the case in Latin America? And if not, why not?
So Russia has been able to change a lot of perceptions. And I think different from some of the other actors that we're talking about, Iran and China, Russia has a much longer history in Latin America because of the Cold War and the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was a major player in Latin America throughout the Cold War. Most people are probably familiar with the Central America Sandinistas and the different communist movements that were in support of the Soviet Union. Probably everybody remembers the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. But actually, many people may not know that the Soviet Union was very involved in countries like Chile in propping up communist dictatorships or attempting to prop up communist dictatorships in those countries, Peru, and other countries in South America. So the Soviets have been involved in Latin America for a long time. So they left a footprint. Obviously, the Soviet Union collapsed, and then resurgence of Russia, so to speak, under Vladimir Putin. They didn't have to start from zero, as the Iranians did in many cases and others. They had a network that they could establish with. The Cuban network, which is a communist network in Latin America, was also very well entrenched into different countries. But what I say where the Russians have done tremendous amount of work, and I think this is something that U.S. Southern Command and other intelligence and defense entities are very much focused on, is in their media and their messaging. Russian, Spanish, and Portuguese language disinformation is among the biggest in that language. It's rivals the United States, it rivals other major media markets in Latin America, such as Mexico and Colombia, which are big, and obviously for Portuguese to be Brazil. Just to give you a data point on that, Russian TV, RT Espanol, which is the Spanish version for RT, social media following has grown over 25 million followers on its different social media accounts. And that's just one state-owned media platform. If you had Sputnik Mundo, if you had the different languages. So they're rivaling major media networks in Latin America. China can't say that, neither can Iran. They have state media networks in Spanish and Portuguese as well, but they're not at that level. And what this has done, and those that follow RT or Russian propaganda or even Russian disinformation know that it muddles the water with a lot of the narratives. It muddles the water with a lot of people's perceptions, not just on democracy, but their perceptions on the United States, their perceptions on things that are going as far afield as the Ukraine war, even things that their allies are involved in, such as the Uyghur issue in China, or the Syria conflict, or the Iraq-Afghanistan conflict in the Middle East and Eurasia. So Russia is messaging its interpretation of these international developments in a way that's obviously favorable to them, but also in a way that's favorable to their international allies, notably Iran and China. So I think on the foreign disinformation side, and part of it's disinformation and part of it's just straight propaganda, on foreign propaganda, Russia has definitely evolved, surpassing what the Soviet Union had during its heyday.
I think that's fascinating, and I want to drill down on that a little bit, because the obvious question here is, what are the effects of this penetration? What have the Russians been saying to audiences in Latin America, both about Ukraine and the current war and about the West more broadly? And also, equally importantly, has this messaging been effective? Have the Russians really moved the needle in political terms?
Okay, so I think there's a different ways we can approach that. Let me just start with just a very general, which is, Russia has been good at basically creating confusion. I think that's the best way to describe it. so that there is no such thing as fact. It's all just, everything's open to interpretation and people's perception. And there's a very prominent poll from a Chilean polling firm called Latino Barometer, who works through this Colombian firm called El Pulso. And they did this poll and where they determined that 70% approximately of citizens in Latin America cannot identify whether a news story is true or false. They just don't know what's fake and what's not fake. And I feel like Russia is very good at creating those kind of conditions in the information space. So let me begin by saying, in general, I think the effect of it is adding a lot of confusion. I think that's a big part of what they're attempting to do. But getting a little bit more into the specifics, specifically when it comes to the Ukraine war, Russia has messaged a specific narrative on the Ukraine war that is aimed at two things. It's aimed at, first, delegitimizing the use of sanctions, basically saying that sanctions are a crime against humanity, a crime against human rights, a crime against sovereignty of nation states. They mostly point that at the United States, but they'll point that at the Europeans, they'll point that at the United Nations, they'll point that at anyone that considers sanctioning Russia for its, not just its egregious behavior, but also of its illicit activities, corruption and kleptocracy that spills into financial institutions throughout the world. They'll look at any sanction as, they'll take a victimization approach to any type of sanction, and they'll amplify that. And in Latin America, that means something, because there are countries in Latin America, such as Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, that are also sanctioned. So they kind of help amplify this, you know, we're from the sanctions club. And I think in the case of the Ukraine war, what they really did is they messaged to the South American countries in particular that the United States uses sanctions as a weapon of economic warfare, very arbitrarily. So today it's Russia, tomorrow will be Brazil. Or today it's Russia, tomorrow it's Argentina. And when the United States decides they're going to try to isolate you from the international financial system, and their propaganda around that is that that's a weapon of warfare and it's not a legal economic measurement that would allow the world to have trade in economic relations. So that's what they're doing. And I use this statistic because I think this is very telling. You know, while Russia's done, I think, not as great militarily in the battlefield in Ukraine, I think on the propaganda side, especially at least in Latin America, in Spanish, they've been able to message the fact that they think that their international payment system, you know, they have the SPFS, their own digital payment system, which honestly wasn't very popular outside of Eurasia and their near abroad, Belarus and other countries that signed up for that. But in Latin America, no one had really heard of it. No one really trades in it. But Russia is a trade partner for some specific goods and services. And so what they messaged with the Ukraine war was to say that our payment system is more secure because we will never sanction you for any type of illicit or corrupt behavior. And obviously in Latin America, one of the problems, endemic problems the region has is corruption. So, you know, you get some policymaker that's a little bit nervous and he says, you know what, we'll go ahead and do that. And what we've seen in the data is that Latin America has become more participatory in Russia's payment system. Now, the other side to that, Ilan, the other side of that coin is that Russia had leverage because it is one of the major providers of fertilizer for countries in Latin America, particularly in South America. You know, I often use the example of Brazil. Brazil is an agro-producing country, one of the biggest in the world. Their soy exports, their agro exports are, you know, feed a lot of parts of the world, namely China. And 23% of the fertilizer imports that come to Brazil are from Russia. And obviously, if that's halted or interrupted in any way, I mean, that's going to create not just a damage to their economy, it's going to create damage to the recipient countries of their products, goods and services in agriculture and foodstuffs. So this was a major leverage for Vladimir Putin that combined with his disinformation, combined with propaganda, and combined with its overall strategic diplomacy that they've done in the country, they were able to shift Brazil under a government of President Bolsonaro, which is a more U.S.-friendly government. They were able to shift its foreign policy further away from the United States and closer to Russia, to the point that during the major votes in either the United Nations or in the regional body of the Organization of American States, Brazil abstained from any condemnation of Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. So it had a diplomatic effect and they used it wisely.
And the Russians are messaging something else as well. The idea that animates the Russian war in Ukraine currently, this neo-imperial ethos that obviously Vladimir Putin has, and the idea that Ukraine is territory that somehow must be reclaimed by a greater Russia, is something that really resonates throughout Latin America to a surprising degree. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's very much a part of that disinformation, that propaganda messaging that's beginning to move the needle on how states in the Western Hemisphere think about what Russia's doing over there.
I thought many people, when they were initially analyzing Russia's invasion of Ukraine, were very limited in what they were understanding the scope of what Vladimir Putin was messaging, and thought he's referring to the Soviet Union and reconstructing the Cold War era and recapturing territories that were lost. But I actually looked at it as much broader, much deeper in terms of the historical perspective that Vladimir Putin was putting forward, which is very dangerous because essentially he was legitimizing a narrative that says that if you feel that you are wrong through history and that you lost territory through that history, that you can now reclaim it in some fashion because you think it's legitimately yours. And if we just go through the world, you know, much less Latin America, we just go through the world, how many territories have changed throughout the years? I mean, hundreds, if not thousands. And in Latin America, this is a thing. I mentioned before that there's 33 countries in Latin America, but there's only 33 as of post-World War II, because many of these countries gained their independence 200 years ago. If you go 250 years ago, the region geographically was very different. And so this narrative that Vladimir Putin propagated was basically a gift to authoritarians worldwide, especially in Latin America, who are now using that kind of narrative to be able to try to recreate lost empires of the past. And one of the most notable ones is one that was called the Greater Colombia, La Gran Colombia in Spanish, which was essentially what today is known as the Republics of Colombia, Venezuela, Ecuador, Panama, and three quarters of Guyana and a part of Brazil. So basically, this argument or this false narrative of reconquering lost territory is what Nicolas Maduro, the dictator from Venezuela, is using to try to legitimize his efforts at establishing greater presence in his near abroad and those same countries that I mentioned that was the former Greater Colombia. It's a very dangerous narrative. It really propelled authoritarian aspirations, I think, worldwide. And in Latin America in particular, it's had a tremendous effect. And it's not just, I focus on the Colombia part because everyone knows Maduro and his authoritarian nature, but even the Falkland Islands in Argentina or Belize on the border of Guatemala. I mean, you'd be surprised, Alana, how many border conflicts exist in Latin America for disputed territories that were never fully 100% resolved, but they were peaceful. They weren't armed clashes. We don't have militaries fighting each other. But that seems to be reverting back to that old era where there's potentials for more border conflicts. Maybe it's not through the military, but it's through illicit actors. And that's happening right now.
That's fascinating. And I promised earlier that I would circle back to Iran. And I think this is a good time to do so because it's sort of part of this larger story. The Iranians are also very active in Latin America. And you and I have cooperatively done a lot of work in researching and examining the ways in which Tehran is expanding its political, its economic, and even its cultural influence in both Central and South America. But I wonder, is this happening on the propaganda front as well? What are the Iranians doing? Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, so for one, Iran does not have a soapbox to the level that Russia has. Russia, as I was mentioning before, has grown tremendously in its ability to use its state-owned media as a messaging platform in Spanish and Portuguese. They have, you know, the multi-million follower counts that I was mentioning on social media. So Iran doesn't have a fraction of that. Iran does have a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week Spanish language media network, which is called Hispan TV. But it doesn't have the following that you would see in RT Español or a Sputnik Mundo or things like that. But here's the kicker. Russia integrates Hispan TV and all the Iranian messaging platforms into its broader disinformation network, a broader propaganda network. So it allows it to, it's an amplifier essentially of Iran's propaganda and disinformation efforts in Spanish and Portuguese. And we've seen this very tangibly. Actually, we saw this quite a bit during the different uprisings that have happened in Iran. It was Russian state-owned media that was amplifying the Iranian perspective in Spanish about those protests and kind of downplaying them. One of the disinformation campaigns that we've paid most close attention to here at the center, and I think the one that's very underestimated by many people, is tied to the late General Qasem Soleimani, the late Quds Force commander. Because prior to his assassination in Iraq in 2020, in Latin America, people really didn't know who Soleimani was. He wasn't a household name like Osama bin Laden and some of these other ones that movies have been made after and things like that. But for those of us that knew, we knew the importance of a Qasem Soleimani in the world of counterterrorism, in the world of even organized crime, in the world of Middle East conflicts. And so there was an effort to educate Latin America about Qasem Soleimani. I, you know, helped educate and others did as well. But the response from Iran was then to use that increased visibility and exposure on the name Qasem Soleimani to turn Qasem Soleimani from a slain battlefield commander that was basically starting wars throughout the Middle East to a symbol, much like Che Guevara has become in Latin America, for justice, for anti-terrorism, for martyrdom, and then started introducing this symbol into Latin America, incorporating it with other big symbols such as Hugo Chavez and Che Guevara. Matter of fact, when I was in Colombia, one of the major sites of where they had some of these more Marxist youth movements, communist youth movements in the country, there was a mural that they had spray painted on the wall. And on the mural, you had Che Guevara, you had the late Hugo Chavez, you had some of the now deceased FARC leaders and original FARC commanders like Marulanda, and you had Qasem Soleimani. And it was very telling to me that they would put Soleimani in that context, because they're trying to paint him as a broad symbol of justice and anti-terrorism. So the Soleimani disinformation campaign is very strong. It's much stronger than I think we give it credit for. And you remember, Alon, when we were doing our research years ago, that there was these Islamic centers that Iran would propagate throughout Latin America. And I believe it was Alberto Nisman, the prosecutor that was killed in Argentina, that once called them, he called them antennas of the Iranian revolution. Well, I think today I would call them cell towers, because they're not just intelligence networks that, you know, historically they've been building through these Islamic culture centers. So they were these dual use centers that would do religious and cultural services, but also do intelligence work on behalf of Iran. They are now disinformation centers. They're engaged in both digital disinformation on social media, but also in just, you know, old school standard disinformation by essentially trying to use networks to build political leverage and political actors. And they've evolved from what they were even during the Nisman era, when he was looking at them in the late 1990s and early 2000s. So Iran has a network. They use this information. Russia amplifies it. And one of their biggest weapons in disinformation is using the symbol of Soleimani as a way to kind of basically confuse and disinform Latin Americans about what Iran's true intentions are.
So that's fascinating and terrifying. And it really begs the question, what does all this mean for us, for the United States? We're not focused at all on development south of the border, geopolitically speaking. This is not a new phenomenon, unfortunately. This has been a bipartisan failure for decades. But you're making a convincing case that Russia and Iran and others, what they're doing down there really matters a great deal to U.S. national security. So I wonder, is there a way in which we can push back informationally?
Well, there certainly is. And you're right. I think the United States hasn't focused on Latin America, at least for multiple decades. We used to have a thing called the Monroe Doctrine that actually said we will respect old colonial interests on the old world as long as they respect the new world and the Western Hemisphere where the United States resides. And that was respected for a long time. But it is no longer. China, Russia, and Iran have essentially violated the Monroe Doctrine. But the way that they violated it is because it came with no consequence. So there was no disincentive to engage the region because there was hardly any pushback. As a matter of fact, there was mostly invitations of these networks that were coming in. And so what I've always said is I think the United States, to be able to meaningfully engage in Latin America, it has to do more than just to counter this disinformation, right? Or strategic influence from these external actors. It's not enough to say Peru or Colombia, do not work with Russia and Iran and China. That's not enough to do that. You have to offer something. You have to provide a vision. You have to sell what America is and what American interests are. And in that, we have natural advantages. I mean, if you just look demographically, you can argue that the United States and Latin America are not just geographically closer, but demographically closer than any other region in the world, maybe only Europe, because they're past because of our history. But today, with the rise of Hispanic populations, where I think are approaching 26% of the country and it will be the largest minority in the United States, we're bound by more than just bilateral agreements. We're bound by blood, culture, tradition, geography, demographics. We use none of this when we do our foreign policy in Latin America. You know, it's very much like bad Russia, bad Iran, bad China, listen to us, and then we disappear. And that's not going to work. I mean, the Latin Americans, they don't prefer China. They're left with China. And that's one of the reasons that they're engaged. So I think the first thing the United States has to do is establish a vision, then establish a message around that vision, and come to Latin America and sell what the United States really is and why we have a natural affinity. Because, and frankly, at the end of the day, no country in Latin America, whether it's Mexico, as far as, you know, close to the United States is Mexico, or as far south as Argentina, no country in Latin America is going to be prosperous, is going to be peaceful if the entire region is in disarray. And that includes the United States. It's impossible to have a peaceful, prosperous United States and a Latin America in disarray. That just doesn't work. You know, you look at these external actors that we've been talking about, like, you know, what does the Indo-Pacific mean to China? You know, what does Eurasia mean to Russia, or even, you know, the Eastern Central Europe? What does the Middle East mean to Iran? It means everything. And they're moving to gain power and control of their entire near abroad. Well, the United States is not, right? We're not playing that level of geopolitics in the world. And our adversaries have figured this out, and they figured that this is the soft underbelly, it's the vulnerability, and it's a way to diminish a geographic disadvantage that they've had over time. And you know, the oceans, you know, they always said the United States was blessed with geography, we're blessed with real estate. You know, we're protected by two big oceans, and we have Canada in the north and Mexico in the south. So, you know, things were relatively good, but they figured out a way to get around that. And part of it is disinformation, because information knows no borders, knows no boundaries. It travels faster than people, and it moves quicker than money. So that's essentially been their weapon of choice, to be able to bridge that geographic gap and establish a presence in a way that actually hurts the United States.
That's a great place to stop. There's a lot of work to be done here, obviously. Joseph, thank you so much for taking the time. This has really been a terrific and I think very illuminating conversation.
Thank you, Lon. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you for tuning in to Disinformation Wars. To learn more about the American Foreign Policy Council and our work on public diplomacy, visit us online at www.afpc.org. And as always, we hope you'll join us again next time.